Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sunup. The Daily Sunup podcast is a conversation with the Colorado Sun. See our trust indicators at coloradosun.com/ethics. It's Friday, March 8th. Today, it's time for another chat with a Colorado author. This week, Sun writer and Sun Lit editor Kevin Simpson sits down with a couple whose latest book takes a look at the fate of a massive California ski development proposed by Walt Disney in the 1960s, and the environmental movement that mobilized in opposition. Before we begin, join the Colorado Sun as reporter Jennifer Brown speaks to a panel of experts about how long Denver can sustain the influx of immigrants from South America, and how a volunteer network is filling the gaps. The event is free and will be held virtually on March 12th at 6 p.m. RSVP today at coloradosun.com/events. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. Lafayette Head, a San Luis Valley rancher who died on this day in 1897, led a vibrant life marked by deep integration into Hispano culture and a number of political achievements. He played a crucial role in the American invasion of New Mexico in 1846 and married into a notable Spanish family. He also served as a member of New Mexico's territorial legislature and worked for peace as an agent for Apaches and Utes. Head was elected as Colorado's first lieutenant governor in 1876 and retired after just one term. Before we continue, thanks for listening to the Daily Sunup from the Colorado Sun. Please take a moment to rate and review us in your podcast player. Tell us what you think of the show, share your ideas, and help us reach new listeners. Thank you. Next, our feature story.
Welcome to the end of the work week, listeners. Today, we're talking with Catherine Mayer and Greg Glasgow, co-authors of a new book titled Disneyland on the Mountain, Walt, the Environmentalists, and the Ski Resort That Never Was. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks. Happy to talk with you.
So first of all, tell us a little bit about the Mineral King Valley in California, which is sort of the centerpiece here, and what was going on there in the 1960s?
Yeah, so the Mineral King Valley is sort of in the central part of California near Fresno and Bakersfield, right on the edge of, at that time, was on the edge of Sequoia National Park. And it was a former mining town that had, you know, it really didn't yield much in the way of mining riches, but over the years, the miners started to come back there because it was this really beautiful spot right on the edge of the park, very idyllic. There was a resort that was kind of built up there over the years, a small resort, and then that kind of went by the wayside. And it was most of it, a lot of the, there were cabins and things like that that were on national forest land there. So there's a lot of national forest land and some great mountains all around. And the Forest Service thought this would be a great place for a ski resort. So they had sort of tried to do one back in the 1950s, but it sort of failed, mainly because there was a very primitive, windy road into the area that they just couldn't figure out how to redo so that people could get up there more easily. But in the 60s, they tried again. So the National Forest Service put this land up for bid for someone to come in there and build a ski area. So the person would have been leasing this land from the Forest Service to build a ski area. And there were about six bidders on the project overall, one of whom was Walt Disney. And that was sort of the jumping off point for our book, was about this whole project that he tried to do and why it failed, and sort of the really long battle that ensued after all this.
So what prompted you to not only take on this subject for what would become the first book for both of you, but to actually do it together?
Yeah. So we had, I in particular had been a Disney person for basically my whole life. I had grown up going to the Disney parks with my family and certainly growing up on the films, especially during that kind of Disney resurgence and renaissance again in the late 80s, early 90s. And Greg and I are both journalists by trade, of course. And we had gone to the Walt Disney Family Museum in 2018, I believe, which is a great museum in San Francisco. And we were just kind of going around and and looking at everything. And there was this huge timeline of Walt Disney's life that was there. And it had mentioned that in the 1960s, Walt had tried to build a ski resort in California. And while this sounded vaguely familiar to me, it was kind of a surprise because I hadn't thought about it in so long, and especially enough that, you know, this would actually warrant a piece on this timeline in the museum. And what also interested us is what it mentioned, a man named Willie Schaeffler, and he was a famous skier with Colorado ties, and we recognized his name because he had been the head ski coach at the University of Denver for a number of years. So basically, those couple things really just got us super interested in this story and began to research it, you know, keep coming back to this fact. I can't believe that Disney had tried to build the ski resort. I wonder exactly what this would have looked like. I wonder what happened. Greg and I continued to talk about it. And so we really began to just research this and more or less became obsessed with this story and all that it entailed. And we realized that it was so much more than the fact that he had simply tried to build a ski resort. It really became this monumental thing that had happened in the 1960s into the 1970s and really attracted this environmental movement and backlash, and just was at a really, really interesting time in American history as well. So we just were simply super fascinated by this and thought, man, this would be a really interesting book. And we were pretty surprised that no one had written this. So we thought, hey, let's try to do this and we'll do it together and basically see what happens.
So whose idea was it first to who broached the idea of a book and doing it together?
We honestly can't remember. I don't know. It's just like the more we learned about the story, the more pieces we found, we just kept thinking, boy, this would be a great book. This would be a great book. And then like Catherine said, you know, the fact that no one had written one then was like, should we try it? I mean, we certainly had never written a book before, and we really weren't like out there actively looking for a topic to write a book about. This just seems such like a good topic and so rich. And it was also like during the early days of the COVID pandemic, a lot of it. So a lot of us just like, well, we have a lot of time on our hands. Let's try to do this and, you know, have some constructive project to work on during all this.
So as you mentioned, Catherine, we're going back to a time when Walt Disney and his entertainment brand was really ascendant in American culture. I remember Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color, Sunday nights. That was appointment TV before the phrase even existed.
Yeah.
What prompted him to want to take his company into the ski resort business in the first place?
So to give listeners an idea of the timing of this, this really began for Walt Disney in the early 1960s when he wanted to create this. So this was really not long after Disneyland opened. Disneyland opened in 1955. Walt Disney really started to think about this as early as 1960, and it became official in 1965. So again, not long after Disneyland took off. And Walt Disney was a skier. So that's the first thing to mention. He did care for the sport. He admittedly liked skiing, but also admittedly was not very good at it. I could relate to that. And he just thought, I want to try something else that was also in this experiential situation. You know, this was kind of like a Disneyland. He loved the movie making business. Obviously, things like Snow White and Cinderella really propelled his success and the success of the company. But when Disneyland opened and to rave reviews and people were really excited about it, he had that new passion. He liked to have people come into this special area and want them to have a lot of fun and kind of be in this fantasy land. And this resort that he was trying to create in Mineral King, California was like a Disneyland, but it was also had the benefit of being outdoors, and it wasn't man-made. It was beautiful. It was real. And he wanted people to experience it in that way. And Walt was a big nature lover. That was also something else important to note. So this was really genuine for him because he really cared for the outdoors. He really wanted to make a special area accessible for people that maybe they weren't able to see without the help of transportation and a road and hotels and things like that. And he had created, for instance, a series of films called The True Life Adventures starting in the 1940s, where he did try to educate people about nature and wildlife. And so this was kind of that brand extending really in a really interesting way. So, and the other thing was that Walt Disney also had a big role at the 1960 Winter Olympics, which were held in Squaw Valley, California. And Walt was the chairman of pageantry. So he basically, really everything that we think about as far as big spectacles in the opening ceremonies and the closing ceremonies and the entertainment for the Olympics that we still see to this day is really thanks to Walt Disney, which is really interesting. So it was at those Winter Olympics too that really propelled him to start thinking about this in a really serious way. And certainly people could read all about that in our book, but that's kind of the background of Walt Disney and why he wanted to create this.
So there were a handful of bids for the Forest Service land, but there were two that you describe as standing out. Tell us a little bit about the main competitor here, a guy named Robert Brandt, who it looks like brought a little star power of his own to the bid.
Yeah, it was so interesting that there was these two kind of Hollywood connections to this bidding process. So Robert Brandt was a well-known stockbroker in California. And this area where Mineral King was had sort of been this legendary spot for a while. I mean, people sort of knew that this was a good skiing area. And, you know, some of the business people wanted to kind of jump on it and try to get it built. And Robert Brandt was actually the guy who started sort of the ball rolling. He went to the Forest Service and he said, you know, let's get this moving. And shortly after that is when they put the land up for bid. But his interesting Hollywood connection is that he was married to Janet Leigh, who was just at that point coming off of the movie Psycho that she'd done with Alfred Hitchcock and had done a couple other movies, Bye Bye Birdie being one of them, and some other things. And she was, of course, the mother of Jamie Lee Curtis. So, you know, he became the stepdad to her as well. So that was kind of another interesting part about this story. There kept being all these connections and all these interesting little facts. And that was just another one that we thought would be, you know, an interesting chapter in the book. And the chapter that he appears mainly in is a chapter when Walt and Robert Brandt and the other bidders actually come to a town called Porterville in California to deliver their bids in 1965. And Robert Brandt had a big house trailer that he towed in that had a full scale, you know, mock-up of what he thought the resort would look like with models and plants and things like that. So that was definitely an interesting part of the story.
And I should mention here that that chapter is going to be excerpted in our Sunlit feature this Sunday. So listeners, you can check out Sunlit on Sunday and read all about it. It's a fascinating description of the spectacle of Disney and Brandt descending on this town and making their pitch for the development rights. And of course, the book centers on Walt Disney, but you mentioned earlier, Catherine, that you came across this Colorado connection to the deal in Willie Schaeffler. Tell us a little bit about his role. I know you guys both went to, or at least you went to DU, right, where he was the legendary ski coach, but he also had his name connected with a number of other things, including Denver's Olympic bid.
That's right. Yeah, I did go to DU for my undergrad and graduate degrees. So certainly the name Willie Schaeffler is very famous among the DU community. And Willie Schaeffler was Walt's partner on this, which was really interesting. I think a lot of Coloradans would be surprised to know, you know, how deep these Colorado ties are and the fact that Walt Disney's partner on this was a famous Coloradan. So very interesting. Willie Schaeffler was actually, he was German-born, but then came to Colorado in his early adult years. He had escaped Nazi rule, and so that was really fascinating about him. He's just an unbelievably fascinating guy with a crazy history. We're excited for people to find out more about him. He was a young ski competitor from childhood and was going to compete in the Olympics. Everyone thought he was going to do really well. And he actually had broken both of his legs in competition when he was young. So he wasn't able to do that. But yeah, left Germany with his family. And we had actually come across in a bunch of different archives these letters that he had written when he escaped Germany and decided to come to Colorado. And he had written a bunch of letters to Larry Jump, who was the founder of A Basin. And he had asked Larry, saying, "Hey, I'm a great skier. I have a lot of great experience. Basically, can I have a job?" He had no money, as he said, Willie Schaeffler said, but he had four pairs of skis when he came here. And so he was looking for work, and he got it. He got it working at A Basin. He basically helped create a lot of those runs there. And he had a role in a number of other different Colorado resorts and things like that in the 1950s and things and in that era. And then he became the head ski coach at the University of Denver for several years, where he won just championship after championship. And he became so well known that he was also then recruited for the 1960 Winter Olympics in Squaw Valley, California, where he created a lot of the downhill skiing events and created a lot of those runs that were used in the Olympics. And it was there that he met Walt Disney, and the two became very good friends. So when Walt basically kind of took him aside and said, "Hey, you know, I'm thinking of doing something here. Basically, what do you think? Do you want to help?" And that's basically what happened.
So another thing I want to talk about that you guys address in the book is the environmental movement at the time. I know that you know, the Sierra Club has existed for a long, long time, but how influential were environmentalists in the larger scheme at that point? And was this sort of a breakout moment for them as well?
It definitely was. That was one of the other things about this book that was so interesting, was the timing of it all. And this really happened. I mean, this resort kind of just coincided with the birth of the environmental movement in many ways. The book Silent Spring came out in the early 60s. It was a big treatise on DDT and pesticides, and that spurred a lot of things. And there were just a lot of environmental, you know, crises happening in the world. And even the Sierra Club really at that point was transitioning from being kind of an outdoors club where people got together to go hiking and climbing into this environmental advocacy organization that took on issues like this. And at that point, there weren't a lot of the protections that we have today for the environment. And there was sort of this real fear that, you know, all these beautiful areas in the country were going to end up being developed. So the Mineral King really became this big deal and this big cause for the Sierra Club and for other environmentalists as well. And again, it was this beautiful area, sort of remote, not that accessible, right on the edge of Sequoia National Park. A lot of people thought it should have actually been part of Sequoia National Park, which was one of the reasons that this controversy ensued, is that the highway that would have had to been built to go to this Disney resort would have had to cut through Sequoia National Park. So that was a big deal as well. But yeah, it really coincided with this kind of environmental awakening. And I think it was this high profile case that, you know, was involved Disney, a big company like this. So I think Sierra Club really thought it could, you know, bring some publicity to these issues. And it even, as we say in the book, it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it was sort of one of the first times that the Sierra Club went to the courtroom to fight a battle like this, and definitely the first time they went to the Supreme Court. So it was a very landmark environmental law case at that time.
And I don't think we need a spoiler alert here, since it's their title, but they prevailed. They did prevent this from happening. So it sounds like was that a big win for the environmental movement?
They prevailed. It was a win, but it's interesting because I think, And we thought the same thing. You know, you think, okay, well, there's no resort here. There was a Supreme Court case. So the Supreme Court must have ruled against the resort, and that's why it didn't happen. But in fact, as people can learn more about in the book, the Supreme Court actually ruled in favor of the resort going forward, basically said the Sierra Club didn't have the legal standing to bring this suit. But then, you know, the case was in 1972, and then things just drug on for a number of years. After that, they had to create environmental impact statements. The environmental movement continued to grow. And then eventually, you know, Congress stepped in. There were acts put together, and they prevailed. Yes. In the end, they prevailed, and it was a big victory for them. But at that point, it sort of drug on for so long that I don't know that it maybe had the impact that it would have had had it kind of stopped more immediately. Because at that point, nothing had been built since 1965. So we're talking, you know, over a decade since this whole battle started. So, I mean, it was a victory, but maybe not quite as powerful a one as it might have been if had it happened a little bit earlier.
So you both mentioned that you were fans of Disney. You kind of grew up with them, as so many of us did. But how did you approach the book in terms of balancing the story? Because I know you've mentioned that, in a sense, you know, the motives were pure on both sides here. So what did you mean by that, and how did you approach the whole issue of fairness in your book?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was so important to us to do it in that way. And I think it really became, when we were trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to tell this story? And once we got a good idea of exactly, obviously, what happened and who the participants were, it really was kind of this aha moment. Okay, let's try to tell this in a balanced way. But basically, more or less, every other chapter kind of changed point of view. So let's tell this section from the opponent point of view, and then let's tell this side from the Disney side, you know, the Disney side, and kind of have readers understand those sides and to have sympathy for those sides and just really kind of a greater respect again for both sides, because this is such a nuanced story. It's not black and white. There's so many gray areas. And we talked to several people on the Disney side and the environmental side. And we really did. We really came away with having that understanding and having that sympathy for both sides. And the Disney side, for instance, we really understood that this was a very, very huge passion project for Walt, possibly in more so than his passion for the movies and even for Disneyland, because he really cared about the environment. He was actually lauded by a lot of environmental groups, which was a fascinating part of the story and background that, again, people could read about in the book. But he was really this early conservationist, and he was lauded as such. He actually won awards for his efforts to educate people about the environment and to protect it in certain ways and things like that. He even won an award, a lifetime membership award from the Sierra Club back before this all started. So a lot of really interesting controversies and just back and forth. And then, of course, the environmental movement on that side, that was something that we obviously learned quite a bit about, and we're certainly excited to learn about. But it was so much bigger in some ways than just Mineral King, because it was just such this calling card for the time that we're seeing. We're seeing in the 1960s, 1970s, we're seeing so much more awareness about, should we develop all these areas? Should we not? Should we protect these parts of land? How can we best protect wildlife and nature and everything like that? And so this Disney resort was kind of a sign of that. And it became much bigger than the Disney resort in Mineral King. It really just became a big sign of the time and how important the environmental movement was. So that's kind of how we say that both sides were important, both sides were genuine. And to reconcile what you mentioned at the beginning, how do you reconcile that if you're a Disney fan? I think I am a Disney fan. I have been a Disney person. like a lot of people are obviously growing up with Disney, but I also take my role and my job as a writer and a journalist, and probably more important than that, in telling things in a very fair way. So
it's always interesting. You talk about the craft of writing. It's interesting to talk to co-authors, especially about the logistics and the process of cobbling together a book, being husband and wife and living under the same roof. How did you balance that creative process with, you know, just everyday life? I mean, was the book always sort of this focal point during the process, which incidentally included the pandemic? Or were you able to set it aside from time to time and have a life outside of work?
Yeah, I would say it was our focal point a lot. I mean, we were able to set it aside some, but it definitely is something that we sort of live for probably a year or two, whereas really something we were talking about all the time, working on all the time, you know, nights and weekends for sure. But I think the book became better for that in a way, in that a lot of co-authors probably, maybe they meet, you know, over Zoom a couple times a week, or they send drafts back and forth. But we were talking about this as we were making dinner or walking the dog, and like, oh, what if we did this for this chapter? Or what if we talked to this person? And it really, I think, became richer because of the fact that it was just the center of our lives. And again, I mean, during the pandemic, it gave us something kind of positive to focus on. So it was our life for a while, but I think that's a good thing. You know, we were able to set aside time to do other things, of course, now and again, but for the most part, really for that period of time, this was what we focused definitely the majority of our energy on.
Anything you'd like to add to that, Catherine?
When he was saying that, I just thought, you know, what a privilege that is when you can focus on something and you enjoy it so much. I think as writers, especially, you know, we have day jobs, and as writers, and a lot of it is, you know, slugging along and doing things like that. And sometimes you're working on something that just excites you so much. And that's really a privilege. And I feel like that's what this book really was for us. We feel really honored that we got to tell a story that a lot of people didn't know and haven't read, and to tell something about that we enjoy, like the rich Disney history, but also a rich piece of American history and environmental history. We're really happy and privileged to do that.
Well, we've been talking with Catherine Mayer and Greg Glasgow. Their new book is Disneyland on the Mountain: Walt, the Environmentalist, and the Ski Resort That Never Was. And you can read just a terrific excerpt this Sunday in our Sunlit Book feature, and also learn more about the co-authors and their Q&A. Catherine, Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks very much.
Yes, Kevin, thank you so much. This was great.
And as always, listeners, if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review on whatever platform you use to tune in. Thanks, and have a great weekend.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Keystone Ski Patrollers are preparing to take another run at forming a union, joining a budding trend among workers in the resort industry. The push comes as ski patrols at five resorts in the West have announced plans to join a union. In the past couple of years, patrollers at Breckenridge, Loveland, and Purgatory have voted to unionize. Lift mechanics at Crested Butte Mountain Resort and Park City in Utah have also unionized in the past 2 years. All are part of the United Professional Ski Patrols of America, which represents 700 patrollers and lift mechanics at the 10 ski areas in the western U.S. A power line belonging to Xcel Energy ignited a massive wildfire in Texas that destroyed homes and killed livestock. Texas officials blamed a power line the same day Xcel acknowledged its equipment appeared to have sparked the Smokehouse Creek Fire, which burned nearly 1,700 square miles and destroyed hundreds of structures last week. An Xcel power line also was blamed for helping start Colorado's Marshall Fire that killed two people and destroyed more than 1,000 homes in 2021. Xcel has denied it was negligent in both fires. The utility is facing a lawsuit from more than 150 insurance companies that insured owners of property that was burned in the Marshall Fire. States in the Colorado River Basin are pitching new ways to absorb water shortages, even as they clash on the approach. the Upper Basin states of Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico, and Utah submitted a proposal that would require cuts in usage for the Lower Basin. But the Lower Basin states of Nevada, California, and Arizona say they want a more equitable way of distributing cuts that would be a 50-50 split between the basins once a threshold is hit. The Bureau of Reclamation says it will decide on a plan by November. The agency said the goal is to reach a consensus among the states for how to distribute water to 40 million people in the West. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Now, a quick message from our team.
This is Michael Booth.
And this is John Ingold. We cover health and climate here at the Colorado Sun.
Every week, John and I work together to send out a newsletter to our premium members called The Temperature.
In this newsletter, we share our latest reporting about health and climate and how they intersect. Issues like forever chemicals, healthcare's rising costs, and the lingering effects of the pandemic. The Temperature is one of our weekly newsletters available to members at the premium level.
To sign up, head to coloradosun.com/join. Not only will you be able to sign up for The Temperature and our other premium newsletters, but you'll be supporting the Colorado Sun as a member, and thanks for doing that.